quantum gravity, and in particular loop quantum gravity. And so as an introduction, so the standard, probably very standard introduction by now, so you know that what we're interested in is bottom-up approaches to quantum gravity. So the philosophy that we adopt is that if general relativity is the geometry of space-time, so gravity is geometry, maybe there's a slight chance that having a notion of quantum gravity could be the same as having a description in terms of quantum geometry. So what we would like to do is start with some description of quantum geometry, so we can choose what our preferred description of quantum geometry is. For example, loop quantum gravity or group field theory, as we heard from Sylvain, or any other kind of approaches. But then all these discrete approaches to quantum gravity share the same key fundamental problem, namely, how does the smooth diffeomorphism invariant space-time that we see around us emerge from these fundamentally discrete descriptions? So if you want to ask a slightly more technical question, then we can ask, in terms of spinful models, what are the phases of these models? And especially, are there phase transitions in these spinful models? And then one very important goal on the longer range is that once we even identify these phases of spinful models and phase transitions towards the continuum, how can we extract physics from these models? So as a very quick summary, so we know that in loop quantum gravity and spin foams, what we do is that we work with holonomies and fluxes, and these data, they encode the intrinsic and extrinsic geometry of hypersurfaces, so spatial geometry. And then what we have in loop quantum gravity is a very nice description of a diffeomorphism invariant Hilbert space, and this Hilbert space supports the quantum algebra of holonomies and fluxes, which is encoding this spatial geometry. And because of this construction, we are able to derive at the level of this Hilbert space some notion of quantum geometry. So this is really the core central result of loop quantum gravity. And so one sort of question which we heard very often in this conference is, what is really the status of the spin foam amplitudes which we construct as the dynamics of canonical loop quantum gravity? So should these amplitudes be thought of as being fundamental or just something auxiliary? And so I had the, in fact, I have this here because I wanted to comment about this, but I just moved the comment slides to the end of the talk. So I just now go to the main part of the talk, and if I have time, I will go back to the comments. So the motivation is that in usual loop quantum gravity, we work with the so-called Ashtekar-Lewandowski representation, which is also due to the work of Aishan. And this, in this representation, we start with a vacuum state, and this vacuum state is represented here on the slide. So it's just a state with no excitations, which means a state with no graphs, and expectation values of any power of the fluxes smeared along any surface in this Ashtekar-Lewandowski vacuum is vanishing. Now, on top of this vacuum, we have creation operators, and these creation operators are holonomies of the connection associated to links of the graph. And once we excite the vacuum with these holonomy operators, we have some notion of spatial quantum geometry, but this geometry is completely degenerate in the sense that it vanishes completely in the vacuum, and it's only peaked and degenerate on the spin network graphs. So we would have vanishing geometry everywhere outside of this graph and only geometry localized on this graph. So this is a totally squeezed and degenerate state. So it's a very particular vacuum state, but it's the most natural and straightforward diffeomorphism invariant vacuum that we can think about, which is maybe why it was used in the first place. Now, the structure that we have is that we have a discrete basis of excitations, and these excitations are labeled by these discrete graphs, because excitations are encoded by these holonomy operators. Now, because we have a nice notion of how to embed graphs into one another, we can in turn have also a notion of how to embed the Hilbert spaces associated to the graphs into one another. And because we can do this, so using what I will later on describe as a vacuum, we have a notion of how to refine states and embed states, or rather embed Hilbert spaces into one another. And by using this embedding, what we can do, in fact, is construct a continuum Hilbert space. So what I represented here is just going from one state to the other. So I'm refining this state. And in this Ashtekar-Lewandowski vacuum, if we refine a state, we just add some links of this spinetric graph, and you just put the spins to be equal to zero. So now this looks like we are dealing with discrete structures, but as we all know, they are fundamentally continuum mathematical structures behind this seemingly discrete formulation. So we know that in loop quantum gravity, if we start with a discrete graph Hilbert space, which is just constructed in terms of representations of SU2 associated to links and nodes. What we can construct, so precisely because we have this notion of how to embed graphs into one another and how to embed Hilbert spaces into one another, what we can construct, in fact, is what we call an inductive limit of Hilbert spaces. So schematically, this would be constructed by taking the union of all these graph Hilbert spaces and then dividing by some equivalence relation. And there's a classic result by Ashtekar and Lewandowski that this can be realized at some really continuous L2 Hilbert space over this space of generalized connections. So now there is a notion which will be fundamental for that I would like to describe for this talk. It's the notion of having gravity as a topological theory with some defects. And what we have in mind is to construct quantum gravity as a topological quantum field theory, also with defects. And so this is a question which some people asked and which we studied also with Laurent Freidel and Jonathan Zipric. The question is, what is the interpretation of the discrete phase space of loop quantum gravity in terms of continuum structures? And if we ask this question, we can in fact see that we can interpret this discrete holonomy flux, so discrete spin network data on a fixed graph, in terms of the continuum phase space of GR. But clearly, this map is not one-to-one. We cannot reconstruct any continuum, any point in the continuum phase space of GR starting from holonomy flux data. But rather, what we can construct is classes of almost everywhere flat connections. So geometries in the phase space of first order gravity, where the connection is almost everywhere flat. So if we push this reasoning a bit further, we see that we have this sort of flatness constraint, which is telling us how we construct this space of flat configurations in the continuum. But because of this flatness constraint, in fact, all these configurations in the continuum, which we can reconstruct from discrete holonomy flux data, are related by some gauge orbits, in fact. So this flatness constraint generates gauge transformations, and we can use this freedom to reconstruct many different continuum data starting from the discrete holonomy flux data. So a discrete holonomy flux data, so a point in the discrete phase space of loop quantum gravity, corresponds to a kind of equivalence class of continuum structures. Then we can ask what kind of explicit continuum structures can we reconstruct from these discrete holonomy flux data. And we try to show and argue that we can reconstruct two particular kind of continuum structures. And in one of these continuum structures, which we call the Ashtekar-Lewandowski gauge, so for reason which I try to explain here, the electric field, so the continuum electric field, is almost everywhere vanishing, which is exactly what happens in the Ashtekar-Lewandowski vacuum. What I said on the previous slide is that in this vacuum, if we are not sitting on the edge of a spin network, the spatial geometry is completely degenerate and vanishing. So in this gauge, the continuous electric field is kind of a heuristic delta function peaked on the spin network link. But what is very interesting is that there is another particular representative in this equivalence class of continuum geometries, namely what we call this BF gauge. In this BF gauge, we can kind of use the freedom which is obtained by acting with this flatness constraint in the continuum to construct an electric field or prove that an electric field exists which is almost everywhere flat. So this has to be thought of as kind of a completely a flat gauge rather than a degenerate gauge. So the nature of geometry in these two pictures is completely different. So in the Ashtekar-Lewandowski representation, it should be clear from the previous slide and also maybe this discussion that in the Ashtekar-Lewandowski representations, we have a kind of trivial topological theory in the vacuum because there is no graph, no geometry. And the defects on top of this vacuum, they generate the geometry themselves. So the geometry is carried by the defects themselves. So what we would like to construct here, what we have in mind, is construct a representation which is closer to this continuum interpretation, namely the fact that we want to have a topological theory with defects, but what we want is that the defects generate curvature instead of generating geometry. So again, what we have in mind is to construct quantum gravity as a topological quantum field theory with defects. What we need for this, what we need to construct now, is sort of a continuum Hilbert space which can support arbitrarily many excitations, so in the form of these curvature defects, and also some algebra of observables which can generate these excitations on top of a vacuum. So this is what we would like to construct. Now, if we start in this program, we sort of have a first question to answer and something to think about, which is this uniqueness result of loop quantum gravity. So in this uniqueness result, we know that, so it's a very technical result, but it's telling us essentially that up to some very technical assumptions, the Ashtekar-Domodossky representation, which I just briefly described, is in fact unique. And among these assumptions, you can find in the paper that we impose diffeomorphism invariants, and also the fact that the fluxes themselves have to exist as operators. So if we think of working, I think like Christian Fleischack did to prove this theorem with the exponentiated version of the fluxes, so the Weyl algebra, we have to require that these exponentiated fluxes be weakly continuous in the exponentiating parameter, so that the fluxes themselves exist. So this uniqueness result, which is always something that people in loop quantum gravity are very proud of, is in fact a kind of striking result because it's very different from what happens in usual QFT, where there can be many different inequivalent representations. So why is this not the case here? And again, because in the Ashtekar-Lewandowski picture, the geometry is generated by these defects, and the geometry is completely degenerate. This means that if you want to reconstruct, have a notion of smooth continuum geometry, we have to have many, many, many defects on top of the vacuum. So this sort of makes it cumbersome and complicated to construct nice semi-classical states. What we need, rather, is a notion of condensate states. So this is kind of a difficulty in working with this Ashtekar-Lewandowski picture, among other difficulties which we hopefully will try to overcome. So then we can try to ask the question if we can find, in fact, other representations, inequivalent representations to this one. So clearly, because of this uniqueness result, if you want to have different inequivalent representations, we have to violate some assumptions of this uniqueness theorem. So what we can do, for example, is introduce a constant background geometry. This is what was proposed by Tim Koslowski and Hanno Salman, and then studied by these two people. And here the idea is that expectations values of the fluxes in this new vacuum state is fixed to some fiducial background geometry. So if you want to use this vacuum, we are indeed violating one of these assumptions, namely the fact that this notion of diffeomorphism invariance has to be replaced by some suitable notion of diffeomorphism covariance in this picture. Now what we can also do is try, in some sense that I will try to make more precise, dualize all the ingredients of this Ashtekar-Lewandowski construction, and this will indeed take us to this BF representation. Then once we have this BF representation, we have to sort of go back to this uniqueness result and ask which of these assumptions are we violating. And in fact, we're going to violate this assumption that the fluxes themselves exist as operators. So just to summarize the results in a nutshell, so before deriving the results, I'll just summarize what was achieved. So in this BF representation, we have again a cyclic vacuum state, but now the vacuum state, instead of being peaked on degenerate configurations of the fluxes, it's peaked on locally and globally flat connections. So schematically, we just write this vacuum as vacuum in which the curvature of the connection is vanishing. Then,
sorry.
Yeah.
So it's an expectation value or a strong value? So does the curvature operator annihilate the vacuum? Or is it just that you look for expectation value?
Oh, it's strongly, in fact. I mean, this is, yeah, just to stick to the notations from before. But it's very schematic. So here I'm just writing the same bullet points as in the Ashtekar-Lewandowski picture from before. So all the points are the analog of what was before. So the first one is how to define this vacuum. So it's a vacuum peaked on flat connections. Second point is that we have creation operators, so excitations on top of this vacuum. But now instead of being Wilson lines, so holonomies of the connection, these excitations are rather to be thought of as Wilson surfaces. So exponentiated versions of the fluxes instead of exponentials of the holonomies. So Wilson surfaces are the creation operators. And for the AL representation, I wrote in the third point that the vacuum is not really a physical state because it's a highly degenerate state, so a very particular degenerate state. Here, rather, in this BF representation, the vacuum is, in fact, a physical state of BF theory. So in particular, for 2 plus 1 dimensional gravity, this vacuum would be a physical vacuum in the sense of, for example, the program of Bianca, and I think she maybe mentioned this in her slides, that so we'll also argue this, that we have to try to work with a vacuum which is dictated by the dynamics of the theory. and corresponds really to refinement maps given by the spin form amplitudes. So this is explicitly realized here. Yes?
So in this one, the curvature is like living on the surfaces and the two faces or
So depending on the dimension, the curvature is supported on hinges of the triangulation. So this would be vertices in two dimensions and bones, so edges of the triangulation in three dimensions. So I will explicitly describe this in two dimensions. So then again, we have a discrete basis of excitations, but now instead of being labeled by just discrete embedded graphs, now the excitations are labeled by simplices of the triangulation. So I'm just writing this to emphasize that in this representation, it's really, in this sense, dual to the usual loop quantum gravity picture, because we rather focus and work with structures which are constructed out of the triangulation itself. Whereas in loop quantum gravity, usually we can, in fact, if we want, completely forget about the triangulation picture. Here, the simplicial setting is very important. So then, because we have, again, a notion of how to embed triangulations into one another, we can say if a triangulation is coarser or finer than another triangulation, we can, in turn, embed the corresponding Hilbert spaces into one another. And because we can do this, and we have a suitable notion of cylindrical consistency, which comes with this embedding of Hilbert spaces into one another, we can, in fact, again, in a similar way as in the Ashtekar-Lewandowski construction, define a continuum Hilbert space, which supports all these excitations. And we're going to see that to construct this continuum Hilbert space, we need a very particular and peculiar discrete topology on the group. And this corresponds to a compactification of these fluxes. And in turn, this provides a new realization of quantum geometry. And another more technical point is that to construct this representation and this vacuum, we have to work with these so-called gauge covariant fluxes. So you know that in loop quantum gravity, you can work with two different types of fluxes. You can work with just kind of a trivial smearing of the electric field along any surface in three dimensions or along any one-dimensional line in two dimensions. But you can also work with gauge covariant fluxes. So these fluxes have the property of transforming nicely under and locally under SU2 gauge transformations. And these fluxes depend on both the continuum electric field and also on the connection, because you need to add some parallel transport to define these covariant fluxes. And before, it was always not really known how to work with these gauge covariant simplicial fluxes. So this we can achieve in this representation. And in fact, because we work with these gauge covariant fluxes, this gives rise to a sort of a phenomenon which is rather trivial, in fact, but which we named curvature-induced torsion. And this is similar to what happens in cross-graining of spin network that Etera did, and I think this was mentioned in the discussion, namely the fact that if we start cross-graining spin networks, at some point we can violate the Gauss constraint at the vertices because there is curvature information being encoded in these vertices. So here the same thing happens. So I haven't told you how to define these bold fluxes here, but essentially these bold fluxes are the basic flux operators which we have in this representation. So they are made, they are built out of these elementary simplicial fluxes associated to these edges of the triangulation. So here we see that if we take this sort of composite fluxes, which is built on these three edges of the triangulation, if the curvature around this central vertex is not vanishing, in fact, this flux is not going to be vanishing. So there is this violation of the Gauss constraint because there is curvature located at this vertex. So this representation sort of has this feature and enables us to deal with this feature sort of from scratch. So this is a feature which is built in this representation. So maybe because of this, this will be more useful and the correct tool that we can use to coarse grain the fluxes, in fact, or to coarse grain these geometries. So now I move on to the sort of second part, which is how to construct explicitly this representation. So first, we have to ask what the configuration space is. So as I said, the setting of this representation is a simplicial version of loop quantum gravity. So for this simplicial version, what we need is first some triangulation delta of some, say, d-dimensional spatial manifold, which we can take to be, say, a closed manifold. So this is my triangulation delta. And then once we have this triangulation, we can consider the graph, which is dual to this triangulation delta. And then, as I said, we work with these simplicial gauge covariant fluxes. Now we have to ask where the connection degrees of freedom are encoded in this picture. And as we know, the curvature of the connection is encoded in holonomies around d minus two dimensional simplices. And now I choose, sort of switch the language, and I start calling these d minus two dimensional simplices defects, because what we have in mind is that later on, we will have sort of creation operators which are putting defects, which are putting curvature on these vertices of the triangulation. And if we start putting curvature on these vertices of the triangulation, typically the parallel transports, for example, which is involved in the definition of these simplicial fluxes, is not really allowed to cross these regions anymore, because these regions, so these vertices carry non-trivial curvature. So this means in some sense that these regions have to be seen as defects of the triangulation, because they carry curvature, so we cannot just move freely the parallel transport for the fluxes around in the triangulation because of these curvature regions. So if you want to describe now the space of flat connections on this manifold with defects, so what we have in mind is to construct this moduli space of flat connections. So it's just the set of all the flat SU2 connections on the manifold sigma, removed from all the d minus two dimensional simplices of its triangulation and modulo gauge transformations. So what we can show is that this is in fact sort of isomorphic to the space of homomorphisms from this fundamental group of this defected manifold into the gauge group G. And there is a very nice characterization of this space, in fact, which can be obtained by choosing a tree in this dual graph gamma. So to just summarize, so we take a triangulation of the manifold, which is delta, then we take the dual graph to this triangulation, and then in this dual graph, we can choose a maximal spanning tree. And this spanning tree has a set of leaves, and these leaves of the tree are in fact in one-to-one correspondence with the fundamental cycles of this graph. So you can understand easily that what is going on here, by making a choice of tree and selecting a set of leaves in this graph, what we have is a way of describing in a non-redundant manner all the independent cycles of the graph. And we want to have a characterization of all the independent cycles of the graph, because these cycles, or rather the holonomies around these cycles, encode the curvature carried by these defects. So if you choose, in fact, a tree in this graph, this gives us, in fact, a gauge fixing of all the connection degrees of freedom on the tree. And what we are left with is just non-trivial gauge transformations at the root of the tree. So we have to, just a technical point, that we have to take care of these residual gauge transformations at the end of our construction. Now we can ask how to construct the quantum theory just on a fixed triangulation. So what we have in mind, what we want to do is work with wave functions, which depend on this collection of group elements, GL. So this is just the collection of holonomies which are associated to these leaves. So the set of holonomies associated to these fundamental cycles of the graph. Now what we also have in mind is to go from one triangulation to the other. So we want to do refinements of triangulations and embed triangulations into one another. So because we have Hilbert spaces associated to these triangulations, we have to sort of ask what happens to our states. And what we want to do here is also ask what happens to the inner product when we go from one Hilbert space to the other. And we can understand that if we go from one, if we choose a finer triangulation, so if you take a coarse and a fine triangulation, the finer triangulation will have more independent cycles. So the graph will be slightly bigger, and it will contain more fundamental cycles. So what we want to ask, so a very sort of natural and let's say zeroth order requirement for the construction of the quantum theory, is that states in this finer Hilbert space, which arise from the embedding of states in the coarser Hilbert space, must have finite norm. So this means that we consider states which depend on additional holonomies here, additional cycle holonomies, and we kind of want the curvature information which is carried by these additional cycle holonomies to not give us divergences once we compute the inner product. So we want these states which we get from embeddings to have finite norm. So the way to construct this inner product which satisfies this property, one way to do this is we can choose some auxiliary inner product, let's say, for example, the usual Haar inner product. Then we can choose a family of states which are regulated in such a way that they have finite norm in this auxiliary inner product. And once we have this, we can use the vacuum state. So the vacuum state would be the state in which all these leaf, so all these fundamental cycle holonomies are set to the identity. So all these holonomies capturing curvature are equal to the identity. And we can use this vacuum and divide by this vacuum and use it as a reference state to define this new regulated now inner product by taking the limit in which this regulator goes to zero. And if we play this game, we can see that we're sort of curing the divergences which we would have if we naively constructed an inner product and comparing states based on different triangulations which with different levels of coarseness or fineness. And what we get is that this inner product goes, in fact, to just a Kronecker delta. So this is.
How is this again an inner product compared to the case of psi 1 by lambda psi, for instance? For this to be an inner product, it should be linear psi 1. But
the denominator is.
Flat one? Ah, flat one. Yeah, so we divide by this vacuum here. Yeah, so this one.
Looks the same.
No, it's not a typo because you cannot see the difference. This one here is in fact this. It's a backslash open. Yeah. No, so this is backslash open one in LaTeX. So it's the So this I meant that these states, all the holonomies are equal to the identity. So then this gives us this Hilbert space, which is in fact non-separable because of this sort of peculiar Kronecker delta inner product, and we can have an orthonormal basis of this Hilbert space and inner product between the states are just Kronecker delta functions on these group elements. So this is sort of a realization of this L2 space over this modular space of flat connections with this discrete measure. And then if we want to go to the full gauge invariant Hilbert space, we have to, so we can do group averaging or algebraic, refined algebraic quantization to take care of the residual gauge transformations acting at the root of the tree. Okay, so now we can ask look at what happens to the fluxes in this representation. So what we sort of said in this guise is that we need this discrete Hilbert space topology, so this Kronecker delta, in order to be able to accommodate the existence of this flat vacuum and also to have this inductive limit construction. Because for this inductive limit construction, we want to, again, compare Hilbert spaces which are coarser or finer than one another. So this means that we will have additional cycles in the finer graph. So additional holonomies in the kind of finer Hilbert space, which have trivial holonomies. And we want this to have finite norm. So because we have this discrete topology, the fluxes themselves don't exist as operators. So this is exactly analogous to what happens in loop quantum cosmology when people work with this so-called Bohr compactification. So in loop quantum cosmology, people have exponential of some parameter mu times usually C, which is the homogeneous isotropic connection. And also the inner product is given by Kronecker delta. So these operators are not weakly continuous in this mu parameter. So you cannot sort of take the derivative and work with the connection representation. You have to work with the exponential of the connection. So now these exponentiated fluxes, or the exponentiated symplectic flow of the fluxes, so which we also called Wilson surface operators, act as just, let's say, for example, right or left derivatives on these group elements. So if we act on the leaf number I, so again, this is the set of all the leaves, so the group elements associated to the leaves of this tree in the dual graph. So if we act on the leaf labeled I, we just shift this group element by, let's say, the value alpha. And then we can look at, for example, the spectrum of these translation operators. So this would be the action of this translation operator with an angle phi on the basis state. It's just shifting this argument in this way. And we can, for example, do this study or look at this for just to group U1. This would just be the spectrum of this translation operator on L2 of U1 with this discrete Kronecker delta measure. And then sort of the standard thing is that two different cases can happen, namely on whether this angle phi is rational or irrational. And depending on whether this angle is rational or irrational, the spectrum will be either continuous or discrete. So now if you want to look at the area operator, so some subtleties arise, namely due to the fact that the area operator is usually written in terms of the electric field itself. So the area operator typically, for example, in three spacetime dimension is just the square root of the contraction, so the gauge invariant contraction, the trace of two elementary fluxes. So, oh, this is just the eigenvectors.
The eigenvectors.
Yeah.
Of R.
Of R, yeah.
And K is the degeneracy.
So yeah.
R5 is the eigenvalue and K is the
yes. So if you want to work with the area, we have to, in fact, replace these fluxes by exponentiated fluxes. So we have to introduce some discreteness parameter mu. And again, this is very similar to what happens in loop quantum cosmology. And because of this, we have to be careful of how to really define an area operator, which is gauge invariant. So maybe I don't comment more on this. But now the important thing is that with this construction, we can, again, just like in the usual Ashtekar-Lewandowski representation, we can define completely continuum structures. So the way to define this is to construct this inductive limit of Hilbert spaces. So what we have so far, again, is a set of triangulations. And to each triangulation, we have associated the Hilbert space H delta. And then these triangulations come with a certain partial order. So if we have this sort of setup where we have all these triangulations related by this partial order, so here we go to finer triangulations and here to coarser triangulations, we can in fact, so if we have suitable refinement maps or projection maps, which are projecting between these different triangulation Hilbert spaces, we can either construct an inductive limit Hilbert space or a projective limit Hilbert space. So what we showed, but I just summarize it like this because it involves just rather annoying technical details, is that we can construct refinement maps which satisfy all the required property to be able to define this inductive limit Hilbert space. So namely, to check this, we have to make sure that we have cylindrical consistency of the inner product once we go from a coarse triangulation to a finer triangulation. So this, so what is sort of happening here in disguise is that we have to study the action of these refinement maps. And these refinement maps, in fact, which is given to us by these BF embeddings, are precisely the action of these of this BF refinement on the states. So I will again comment on this later on when we have the more the spin foam picture interpretation of these refinement maps. So now I just want to make a point of a sort of philosophy to see what is going on here. And this will enable us to go to sort of generalizations of this construction. So one question which we can ask is why we have different vacua and representations for our quantum theory. So again, this is needed in ordinary quantum field theory to describe phase transitions and condensation. So now what can happen is that, so what will happen most likely is that the physical states of quantum gravity, so let's say the states which are in the kernel of all the constraints, in the kernel of the Hamiltonian scalar constraints, will most likely not be in the initial kinematical Hilbert space. So at some point, we will get taken out of this kinematical Hilbert space. But it might very well be that certain physical states, or let's say a class of physical states, are more easily reached by starting from certain vacua. So maybe if we start from a vacuum which is completely degenerate and then create excited states on top of this vacuum, which is completely degenerate, we can only reach a certain region of the, let's say, the set of all the possible states. And maybe we can probe different regions if we start with different vacua. Now, what we always have in mind in this construction of spin foam models and loop quantum gravity is that the path integral dynamics, so which we always try to write as these spin foam models, should be a projector onto the physical states of our theory. So there is this interplay between the physical states of the theory and the path integral. So as I said, the path integral dynamics of loop quantum gravity is supposed to be these spin foam models. But in fact, the spinform models are completely built out of BF theory. So it is sort of natural here in this construction that we have refinement maps, which are given by the amplitudes of BF theory. So this is the reason for which earlier I said that this BF vacuum, at least in 2 plus 1 dimensional gravity, is a physical vacuum, in the sense that it is a vacuum based on refinement maps, which are dictated by the amplitudes of BF theory. And one other way of phrasing this is that these refinement maps are given by, let's say, refining Packner moves. And we know that these refining Packner moves, we can sort of describe them as the gluing of higher dimensional simplices on lower dimensional simplices of the triangulation. So if you have a triangle in the triangulation and we want to do a 1-3 Packner move, we can describe this Packner move by taking this triangle and gluing a tetrahedron on top of the triangle. But then it depends how you refine. So if you refine in this flat way, yes. So if you refine by...
Use new vertices and so on without changing the geometry.
Yeah. So here you refine by Packner moves. So all you do is gluing these amplitudes which are given by these BF amplitudes. So this is a flat refinement. Yeah. Yeah. So this again fits this idea, which is always advocated by Bianca and people working on her program, that the refining maps, so which I hopefully convinced you are related to this choice of vacua, should be selected by the dynamics of the theory. So this is what I just said. So BF vacuum is physical in three-dimensional gravity because the refinement maps are just coming from this Pandinoregi amplitudes. So what we can expect on more general grounds is that if spinforms have non-trivial phase diagrams, as we have many indications from, each phase in this phase diagram will correspond to a lattice realization of a topological quantum field theory. And so I hopefully convince you that there is a sense in which whenever we have a phase, so a lattice realization of a topological quantum field theory, this gives rise to a new vacuum. And we can define excitations on top of this vacuum as defects of this topological quantum field theory. And if you can construct a Hilbert space which carries arbitrarily many excitations in the form of defects on top of this vacuum, then we can get new realizations of quantum geometry. So now I try to make this maybe a bit more general and describe how this can be used to describe a vacuum with a cosmological constant. So the idea is to have a notion of a Tourev Viro vacuum. So refined with amplitudes which are not given by the Pandinoregi amplitudes, but by the Tourev Viro amplitudes. So if we have in mind three-dimensional quantum gravity with a non-vanishing cosmological constant, what we know is that some very general considerations, and we have many indications that this is the case, is that the classical groups of the theory, so which would be the gauge groups of the classical actions, for example, either first-order action or Trans-Simons action, get deformed in the quantum theory. So this also happens even in the case of vanishing cosmological constant in the Trans-Simons formulation. So because this classical gauge group get deformed into quantum groups, we have no clear group picture, group representation anymore. So it's not clear that we can, for example, construct a vacuum in the way that we did, which is just a product over all the leaves of these dual graphs, and then delta functions of these leaf holonomies peaked on some non-zero element of a quantum group. This is, I don't know what this means. So this means that if you want to construct a vacuum for a cosmological constant which is not zero, we have to sort of de-emphasize this point of view of having loop quantum gravity on a graph and looking at these leaves and constructing these delta function states. What we have to do instead is focus rather on the fact that we can derive, hopefully, these different vacuum structures and the excitations from just the structures of this topological quantum field theory and the defects on top of these TQFTs. So this is the main philosophy which is going on here. And so mainly the reason why we think we could do this is due to the fractional quantum Hall effect. So I just took this picture last night. I think this is from the Nobel Prize of 1982, of the people who discovered the fractional quantum Hall effect. And so here you have the intensity of the, so what we're doing is looking at a gas of electrons living on this two-dimensional plane. And then we fuel a magnetic field transversal to this plate. This is the intensity of the magnetic field. And here, in this vertical axis, this is the Hall resistivity of this gas of electrons. And so what happens is that instead of being just a linear function, this Hall resistivity shows little plateaus here at some particular multiples of h or h bar over the charge of the electron squared. And these multiples are either integers, so 4, 3, 2, 1, or are fractional numbers. So for example, let's say 2/3. And so you see that whenever you have a plateau here, you have a massive, so this this curve here, the thing that is doing all the spikes, this is in fact the electric dissipation of the system. So you see that whenever you have, so the coefficient of dissipativity of the system. So whenever you have one of these plateaus, the system has completely zero dissipation. So this is completely clear on this picture. And so when people discovered this, so they first started to try to explain this quantum Hall effect. So then they succeeded into describing the integer quantum Hall effect. So whenever these plateaus correspond to an integer value of this ratio, but in fact the description of the integer, sorry, of the fractional quantum Hall effect is still an open problem, in fact. And this is related to the notion of a topological order, which is thought of to be a new phase that matter can have at very low temperature. And here this is made explicit experimentally by looking at low temperature and very high magnetic fields. So this means that we can have sort of phases of matter, different phases, which are not described anymore by the good old theory of Landau symmetry breaking. So this means that we have no local way of distinguishing between these different phases and these phase transitions. But what happens, and this is this gives the name of topological order, is that these phases are characterized by more global data, topological data. And so this gives to, this is related to a whole new range of phenomena, namely long-range entanglement. Because if these new states of matter, these topological orders, exhibit these very strange properties, it's because we have a collective behavior of fermions. So just like superfluids are collective behaviors of bosons, this is due to collective behaviors of fermions. And these fermions can behave in such a collective way. And also what happens is that usually we have degenerate ground states, which are gapped. This means that these systems are completely stable under small perturbations. And this is only possible if we have patterns of long-range entanglement. So sort of fermions can talk to each other from very far away on this lattice. And so this is also related to what I just said, this issue of having this, the property of having ground state degeneracy. And in fact, excitations on top of these topological orders. So one can see experimentally quasi-particles on top of these topological ordered phases of matter. And these quasi-particles have, in fact, the anionic statistics. So this means that sort of experimentally, people have seen in a lab things which look a lot like topological quantum field theory in two dimensions, and also topological quantum field theory with defects, in fact, because of these quasi-particles with anionic statistics. And all these things here are completely characteristic of this topological quantum field theory. So long-range entanglement, which is in fact also a property of this BF vacuum, which we just constructed. It's a state with long-range entanglement. Ground state degeneracy, which I would make precise in one moment, and anionic statistics. So now it turns out that people have tried to come up with theoretical models to describe this topological order of matter. And in particular, Levine and Venn have come up with this so-called phenomenon of string net condensation. So in this phenomenon of string net condensation, the idea is that we have fixed point wave functions. So these wave functions here, so all these phases are different topological orders, so different sort of phases of matter in this, which show this very strange sort of collective behavior of, let's say, fermions. And so in all these phases, we have fixed points, which Levine and Venn called fixed point wave functions. And these are fixed point of some renormalization group flow. So I just put this here to have a picture which fits the theme of the conference, which is renormalization. But so regardless of this, the main point here is that Levine and Venn have conjectured that these fixed point wave functions, so this fixed point of this renormalization group flow, should satisfy some sort of mathematical axioms. So if we look at these axioms, they seem, so they are motivated on very physical grounds. So what happens if we just move particles around, for example? And if we look at really the mathematical expressions for these physical requirements, people realize, so basically they realize that these are just the axioms of some object called unitary tensor categories or spherical fusion categories. And so the point is that these spherical fusion categories are not a realm of mathematics, which is completely disconnected from topological quantum field theory. And in fact, they are exactly sort of the same thing, because there is an object which exists in the mathematics literature, which is called the extended Touré-Viro invariant, which was defined first by Barrett and Westbury, and then studied by Balzam and Kirillov, which is basically a way to define topological invariants of, let's say, a three-manifold, based not only, let's say, on the deformation of the group SU2, like what was done in the original Touré-Viro paper, but just based on arbitrary bigger structures, namely these unitary tensor categories. So a subcase of this is just the usual Touré-Viro model with representations of UQ of SU2. And so to understand how we can reproduce the same structures as what we had in the BF vacuum, in this case, we can look at, let's say, an example here. So I just want to convince you of the relationship between these string net models and topological quantum field theory. So the relationship between these string net models of Levine and Venn and the Touré-Viro invariants. So what we can do is look at what we can call closed ribbon graphs. So one can take a closed two-dimensional surface sigma and then look at the span of all the trivalent graphs which are embedded in this surface sigma. So we take this surface sigma, we take all the trivalent graphs which are smoothly embedded in this surface, and we require these graphs to be colored by representations, I and j. So these, in fact, these I and j would be in the very broad language and framework, the objects of these fusion categories. But in the case of UQ of SU2, you can think of these as being just irreducible representations of UQ of SU2. So then you color all these graphs with these representations in such a way that all these trivalent vertices are fusion compatible. So in the sense that you have fusion rules when you do recoupling of these representations. So you just have this standard requirement in spin networks, for example, that these vertices have to be fusion compatible. So you can look at the span of all these embedded graphs modulo these local relations. So the first one means that we can smoothly deform this graph. The second one means that whenever we have a bubble in this graph, we can remove it by just getting the quantum dimension of this loop. And this third relation means that we can sort of do recoupling theory to rearrange these incoming and outgoing representations. And I just remove all the indices here to make the notation lighter, but so we know that this f here, so again, in the general notation, these f are just these fusion coefficients telling us how the recoupling theory of this object work. And for UQ of SU2, these f symbols are just proportional to the quantum 6J symbols. So this is just recoupling with quantum 6J symbols. So for example, if you want to look at, we can look at examples, take the sphere, for example. And if we look at what happens for these graphs modulo these relations on the sphere, we can easily convince ourselves that the dimension of this Hilbert space is 1. Then if we do this for a torus, the dimension of this Hilbert space is 4. So So if I can explain this later, maybe. But so if we take the level of the theory to be 1, so this means that for UQ of SU2, we only have 2 spins, namely spin 0 and spin 1/2. So then we have only a few ways of coloring these graphs with these 2 representations. And then it's easy to count by just writing down explicitly a basis for this Hilbert space, that the dimension of this Hilbert space on a torus is just 4. And in fact, there's a systematic way of constructing a basis for this ribbon graph Hilbert space. And this we can just do by using a Penn's decomposition of this surface of higher genus. This is for genus 0, genus 1. And for higher genus, we use a Penn's decomposition to get this basis of this Hilbert space. So the first thing I want to emphasize is that one can think of this Penn's decomposition as sort of the analog of what we did in the BF representation, namely fixing a tree in the dual graph. So I just want to make some analogies, which we can make more precise, but I'm just being on the heuristic level here, between this Turev-Viro construction and what we did for the BF vacuum. So then what we can do is also consider open ribbon graph Hilbert space. So by this, I mean that now we allow all these graphs to have open ends, and we allow these ends to end at marked points of the surface. So for example, we can consider a punctured manifold, let's say a manifold with p punctures. So again, by analogy with what we did in the BF representation, you should think of these punctures as being defects of the manifold. So in 2 dimensions, these punctures should be the vertices of the manifold. And as we saw earlier, in the BF representation, the defects of the manifold, so which are the punctures here, were really the localization of the excitations, because non-trivial curvature was encoded around these defects. So here we can construct similar structures when we have graphs which are allowed to end as these punctures. And there is, again, a systematic way of obtaining a basis of this Hilbert space when graphs are allowed to end at these punctures. So I'm just putting this here and giving an explicit example for the 2 punctured sphere, or the dimension of this Hilbert space is, in fact, 7, to say that we can kind of easily have a prescription for constructing this Hilbert space. Maybe I skip this comment. So then Levine and Venn, in their paper, give a prescription for constructing a Hamiltonian. And this Hamiltonian can be think of as a lattice realization of a 3-dimensional TQFT. So this is in the following sense. This Hamiltonian is typically defined on a honeycomb lattice, a lattice which is made by the gluing of such little elementary honeycomb cells. And this lattice is given by just the sum over the nodes and then the sum over the faces of the lattice of these 2 commuting operators, in fact, where hn is just given by these fusion coefficients. So this hn, so this is a constraint which is acting at all these vertices, is just ensuring that the recoupling of this representation arriving at the vertices is consistent. So this is like imposing gauge invariance at these vertices. So for UQ of SU2, for the Turev-Viro model, this will just be this delta function on these 3 indices, which ensures that all these 3 spins satisfy all these conditions for the recoupling of representations of UQ of SU2. And then the second and the most important part of this Hamiltonian is the part acting on the faces of the honeycomb lattice. And the part acting on the faces, in fact, can be written in the following way. So it is this finite sum over all the spins. And the sum is finite because we consider representations of UQ of SU2. So the sum goes from J to K over 2, where K is some fixed integer. So then you have the quantum dimension DJ of the Jth representation. And then you divide this by this number, which is also familiar in the Turev-Viro model. This is just the total quantum dimension of this space of representations of UQ of SU2. So this typically in the Turev-Viro model, this factor here, it's just a numerical factor, is the weight which is associated to all the bubbles of the triangulation. Sorry, the vertices of the triangulation. And here you have this operator HFJ. So I made explicit this spin J here. And basically the action of this part of the constraint on this face of the honeycomb lattice is just in the following way. So this acts by adding a loop with spin J inside. And then one can use recoupling theory to sort of recombine and rewrite these sort of spinetric loops and strands which are next to one another to have the original state again. What we just pick up in front is just a sum, complicated sum over all the spins, incoming and outgoing here. and essentially six of these fusion coefficients. So six quantum 6J symbols. And now there is a nice theorem, which was proved rigorously by Kirilyov, so the son of Kirilyov, in fact, which is that if you look at now this operator associated to the faces, so HF, so one can, in some sense, forget about this operator at the nodes, because you know that in the definition of these fusion coefficients, the fact that these representations have to satisfy the correct fusion relations is already incorporated in here. So this coefficient would be zero if the three spins coming here did not satisfy these recoupling conditions. So you can forget about these constraints. And if you look at expectation value between, I have to explain this notation, between two graphs of this operator, this is just the Tourette-Virot invariant of this thickened surface. So this means that, imagine that you have a two-dimensional surface sigma, then you take a triangulation of this surface, and you take a graph, you take the dual of this triangulation, so this is a graph, then on the dual to this triangulation, on this graph, you define this Hamiltonian. Then what we can do is take the double, so two copies of this surface, so we have, this is why I write here the surface times minus 1, 1. So you put one copy of the surface at minus 1, one copy of the surface at 1. And we can sort of imagine that this honeycomb lattice is just propagated in this additional time direction. So propagated between minus 1 and 1. So you see that all the triangles, which are dual to these trivalent vertices in this sort of space-time picture, will form a prism. And what we can do is, again, triangulate this prism with three tetrahedra. And then if you just take into account properly which strands are labeled by the spins of these recoupling coefficients, it's a very simple calculation to show that what you get exactly is the right combination of 6J symbols, so quantum 6J symbols, the right combination of these H weights, and the right combination of this denominator, which is this vertices weight, such a way that what you get is just the expression of the Tourette-Virot invariant of this thickened surface. So this means that we just sort of shown heuristically, but again, this can be made at arbitrary level of rigor, because it's a mathematical theorem, that the ground states of this Levine-Venn Hamiltonian just correspond to this Tourette-Virot invariant. Now what we can do is compute, so earlier I talked about ground state degeneracy. And in physical terms, this means that these topological phases of matter, this topological order, are stable under small perturbations. And in mathematical terms, this means that the ground state has a degeneracy which is greater than 1. And so this means that, so this, in fact, this object is just a dimension of this Hilbert space which we introduced earlier. And so to compute it, you can, for example, take the action of this operator on this state, then take the inner product with the same state, sum over all the spins. And if you do this for a torus, for example, the result which you will get is k plus 1 squared. And so earlier I told you that with this Hilbert space, if you just take the torus, you can, just by writing down explicitly, it's very easy, all the four possible graphs that you can have that form a basis of this Hilbert space, you will find 4. And so 4 is for the level k equals 1, when you only have 2 spins. So the general result is here. If you take an arbitrary level k, so you have k plus 1 spins. So on a torus, the dimension of this Hilbert space is k plus 1 squared. And I'm just writing this here because the origin of this square, in fact, is you can think of this as being, so there is a conjectured equivalence between Tourette-Virot invariance and the Trans-Simons invariance. And maybe you know that what we usually state is that the Tourette-Virot invariant is the square of the Trans-Simons invariant. So this is a lattice version of this. This is saying that this lattice Hamiltonian is sort of a lattice realization of Trans-Simons theory. So for Trans-Simons theory at level k, the dimension of the Hilbert space for one chiral copy is just k plus 1 squared. Just k plus 1. And here you have the squared factor because of this equivalence between Tourette-Virot and Trans-Simons squared. OK. So hopefully this should convince you that there is now a structure which is exactly analogous to the structures which we use to construct this BF vacuum with the Ponsano-Regge refining amplitudes. Namely, the fact that we can construct the Hilbert space, we can construct Hamiltonians acting on this Hilbert space. Sort of the space-time picture of the evaluation of this projection operator between two states, two boundary states in space-time, is given by the Tourette-Virou invariant. And what we can also show, that I won't do here, is that one can have quasi-particle excitations on top of this vacuum. So these excitations are located on defects. And what was shown by Balzam and Kirilyov is that these excitations, in fact, are labeled by, again, irreducible representations, but not of the original category, but rather of the Drinfeld center of the category. So in the case of UQ of SU2, for example, this Drinfeld center is just a simple object. It's just two copies of this category of irreducible representations. So two copies with one copy is conjugated, in fact. So this means that on top of this Hilbert space, we have the possibility of describing excitations. Yeah, exactly. So that's the so that's what I tried to say earlier, right? So there is no direct route between. So this would be like saying to describe three-dimensional quantum gravity with a cosmological constant, we can do two things, right? We can either start with built-in quantum group structures, so put them by hand and then see what happens, or we can start with a classical spin network and see how, if you want to do the canonical quantization of this classical spin network, they get quantum deformed. So what I try to argue is that here it's probably complicated to start from our vacuum and show that when you put the cosmological constant, everything gets quantum deformed. So this sense of the arrow is quite complicated. So this is why I try to argue that, because this is probably complicated, maybe there's a way to do it, but I don't know what it is, mostly because of the fact that we worked in the group representation to construct our vacuum, and not in the spin representation.
So in that order, I think maybe you're asking for the order of states, and this might be discussed at the very beginning. And so the point is
I'm just wondering about
the strategy. I think the question is these are like Q deformed spin networks.
Yeah.
But non Q deformed spin networks don't span your new Hilbert space because they are not normalized.
Now we're saying completely different things, I think. Now I think, I mean, tell me if this answers your question, but I think that what we try to do here is that I don't know how to start from our vacuum, show that you turn on the cosmological constant and this quantum deforms all the structure. I don't know how to do this. So rather I try to de-emphasize this spin network and loop quantum gravity interpretation and just try to focus on the TQFT side. And then if you look on just this side, you realize that all these structures exist and all these structures really mimic the ingredients that you needed for the construction of a vacuum. So in fact, you can even go beyond these just representations of UQ of SU2 and construct such a vacuum and excitation on top of any TQFT, which are in fact classified because this is in one-to-one correspondence with the classification of these fusion categories. Start with it. Okay, but then the final slide. So hopefully I convince you that there is a new framework and new set of results. So we can construct a full continuum Hilbert space which supports arbitrarily many curvature excitations. So this allows now for geometrical cross-graining of the fluxes because we work with the fluxes as our fundamental variables. What I didn't talk about is that there is a nice geometrical realization of the action of diffeomorphisms. For example, in two dimensions, in two spatial dimensions, you can see the action of these diffeomorphisms just as a vertex displacement. This is a new take on the study of the dynamics of the theory. Yeah, because in three dimensions, so I mean, you have to break some symmetries, right? We expect diffeomorphism to be moving the edges around. So it's not really clear what happens because of simplicity constraints. So. So this is also a new realization of quantum geometry. And we can generalize these structures to sort of a broader class of topological quantum field theories. And hopefully this is the way to accommodate for the presence of a non-zero cosmological constant. Okay, and possible generalizations and applications. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, coming to the Bianca-Marc vacuum. So you do a particular construction to achieve some local consistency in a vector Fourier space.
I would say yes and no for sort of trivial reasons. Is that so? First of all, this construction relies on some auxiliary inputs, right? So we made the choice of working with triangulations. For example, this is a choice. You could relax this choice and get different constructions. So probably if you relaxed these hypotheses, for example, consider more general things as than triangulations, you would. Here you would get the same, probably the same representation. So now if you ask how we could get different representations, which are not equivalent to this one, you probably again would have to violate one of these assumptions of this theorem. So here, this representation satisfies diffeomorphism invariance, and the fluxes don't exist as operators. So maybe if you have a representation that sort of bypasses one of these two, you can have something.
But it is unique if you start with the triangulations and
okay. I mean there's no proof of this, but probably
it's a question of how it could work to the existence of topological quantum field theories. And so far in 3D they're not all classified, but it might be that 2+1 they don't exist anymore in topological quantum field theories, which carries an application beyond that. And then 3+1 is completely wrong. Beyond that, there's a question whether one can build a vacuum with different methods, which is different from topological quantum field theory with defects, which would be very interesting, but I think that one would be very interesting to revisit the interesting one to see whether I'm physically similar.
But even with different DQFTs, it's not clear how they would be related by two representations.
Possibilities, that would be great. It has to be communicated to the others.